Robert Silvers, editor of the New York Review of Books. You're listening to a New York Review podcast.
I'm Gabriel Winsley-Yost of the New York Review, and I'm speaking with Dan Chasen, poet and critic. His review of the collected stories of Lydia Davis appears in the April 29th issue of the New York Review. Davis is a renowned translator as well as a writer of fiction, and her short stories, many as short as a single sentence, have recently been collected and published to great acclaim by Farrah Straus. So, hi, Dan.
Hey, Gabe.
I thought we would begin at the end of your review.
Sure.
There you write that in the collected stories of Lydia Davis, almost as if by accident, Davis has made one of the great books in recent literature. So that's a strong and a somewhat odd statement. Could you talk a little bit about what makes this book so great and what is so sort of accidental about it?
Well, it is great because it is, I think, so comprehensive, so varied, so big, so broad, takes in so much of human life, human intelligence, has such a paradoxical, rich sense of human nature, amazing ingenuity of language, you know, builds and changes as it goes on. One might have been tempted reading her very first stories to think that she would be a kind of austere kind of practitioner of English rather than a person fully alive to emotion, but as you read it and go through it, more and more what you might call just straightforward personal material makes its way in. So it evolves and builds and changes, and there's a beautiful arc. And so that's why it's great. I mean, I guess that's more or less why any book is great. But the accidental, almost by accident part, I think has to do with the feeling that she works in miniature. And when you read these little miniature stories, you get the sense that she's working in such a vacuum, so hard, almost the way you would work with needlepoint or the way you would work, you know, with tweezers or just at the very, very tip of your fingertips level work. And then to, you know, to take a step back from all of these miniatures and realize, my goodness, there's this huge collection of such things. And that's what felt to me almost accidental or inadvertent about the scope of the achievement. I can't imagine that she intended, even while so immersed in these little tiny things, to build something so huge and comprehensive. So that was what I was thinking when I wrote those sentences.
Well, you selected a couple of stories to read to us
today.
Would you like to read the first one?
Sure. I chose some stories, all of them quite short, that touch on grammar. She's a translator, you know, brilliant translator, most famously of Proust. And you can see from her stories that tinkering with language and figuring out tense and so on is one of the ways she gets a story going. So I think that day-to-day work as a translator has trained her to look for story at the very, very, very smallest, most microscopic level. So she has just a number of stories that are built around problems with grammar. And the first one, it's called Lonely. I think she has a special interest in forms of the future perfect, that is to say, the will have tense, imagining the present from the point of view of the future. And this is one of those stories. It's about the situation of waiting very, very intently for something and then almost choreographing its coming by leaving the scene of waiting. Lonely. No one is calling me. I can't check the answering machine because I have been here all this time. If I go out, someone may call while I'm out. Then I can check the answering machine when I come back in. I think she captures that situation. Of course, you're not told anything about the speaker. You're not told anything about what the message that's being waited for is or what it portends. But that psychological dynamic of wanting something to happen so badly and sort of arranging the past, you know, going out so that the moment that you're in when it's retrospected will be different. That's one example of what she does. There's another one called A Double Negative, which is one that I actually talk about in the piece a little bit. It, I suppose you would say, is a story. If it is a story, it's a story about wanting or not wanting to have a child. That story could be told at great novelistic length. It could be told by creating and refining characters. It could be told by spinning plots. She does it just in a single sentence, and she does it by opening up this little grammar issue of the double negative. Here's the story in its entirety. At a certain point in her life, she realizes it is not so much that she wants to have a child as that she does not want not to have a child or not to have had a child. Unbelievable to me, poignancy in that realization that the, in fact, double negative, but also this future perfect infinitive, really rare bird of grammar, not to have had a child. The realization depends on that little grammatical insight. And so that a story that might have taken 30, 40, 50, 1,000 pages to tell is told really just in one sentence, and it's told by parsing that unusual grammatical problem. The last one I'll read, I can't read the whole thing, but it's called Grammar Questions, and it has to do with the problem of how to talk about what tense to use in talking about someone who's dead. It comes actually quite near the end of her collected stories, and there are a number of very, very moving kind of off-center elegies for her parents, and I take this to be one of them. And if you just think about the range of ways people have talked about their dying or deceased parents or dying or deceased loved ones, it's, of course, very surprising to hear a writer address this most central human topic through such a seemingly cold kind of scalpel operation. But she does it entirely through the lens of grammar. And here's just a little passage from this longer story. She says, "When he is dead, everything to do with him will be in the past tense. Or rather, the sentence, he is dead, will be in the present tense, and also questions such as, where are they taking him, or where is he now? But then I won't know if the words he and him are correct in the present tense. Is he, once he is dead, still, quote, he? And if so, for how long is he still he?" All these stories get, I think, to how the biggest human topics in here in these tiny little technical questions of language. I don't know anybody else, any other writer, who is able to kind of retrieve or excavate such moving, massive human narratives in the kind of microscopic material of syntax, grammar, and so on.
You introduced them as having to do with grammar, but it struck me as you read them that they were also just as much saturated with loneliness. I mean, the first one was called Lonely.
Yes.
And then it was about this, you know, wanting a child and the death of a man.
Right.
Do you think loneliness is one of the sort of signature subjects of Davis? And do you think that it is it just a coincidence that those stories are simultaneously about grammar and loneliness? Or is there something about her concern for grammar that is also a concern for loneliness?
Yes, or something that she does to fill up the hours, or is it cause or effect? Does sitting around translating make you lonely, or is it something you do because you're lonely? Yes, she's a great writer of loneliness, but, and maybe these are connected, I think even more, she's a great writer of self-amusement. She has figured out, in almost every one of these stories, figured out some way to amuse herself. She's incredibly resourceful in amusing herself and in giving herself tasks that turn idleness into industry. So I think loneliness is a part of it, but there's never that kind of wandering around in the fog bleakness that you associate with kind of irremediable loneliness. She's a person who tinkers, who works. She seems always to be writing kind of amongst the materials of her shop, and she is just incredibly resourceful in bringing to hand whatever will abate that essential loneliness that I think you do absolutely sense in the stories.
One of the things that seems to inevitably come up when people encounter Davis's work is what exactly it is.
Mm-hmm.
Despite the fact that her book is called The Collected Stories, at various times she and others have referred to some of her work as prose poems.
Right.
In an interview last year, she said of one of her late stories, Cows, in that case, I'd say it really is nonfiction. Well, it's really hard to say. When I say we looked out the window, it's slightly an invented character. It's not me writing an essay as myself about the cows in a nonfiction form, but there's very, very little fiction left. So she herself seems a little confused as to what exactly it is she's writing. But yeah. In your review, you maintain that it is really better to think of them as stories.
Right.
Why is this? What is it in her work that strikes you as essentially concerned with narrative?
Yeah. Well, I think her quarrel is with the story, and I think, therefore, the genre she has the most interesting relationship to is story. A few things. I mean, she has a number of stories about stories. Clearly, the question of what a story writer does when she sits down at the table and how the sequencing of information in a story actually ranks information, that's a big concern for her. There's a story in this book called The Center of the Story, and predictably it's about a writer who can't find the center of the story. And it becomes clear that, you know, it really does matter to Davis to think about how what you tell first, second, third, fourth, and last in a way changes the import and meaning of those narrative facts or narrative aspects. So I think she's always thinking about ways around straightforward narrative sequencing, which has as a result an often very conventional ranking of experience. So there are all these stories about stories is the first thing. And, you know, the second thing is just a simple mental exercise that I performed, which was I read some of the ones that seem most like poems just because they're very extremely brief or more abstract than some stories are. I read them with the idea of poetry in mind and tried to imagine, well, what if I had encountered this in a poetry journal or in a book of poems? And they weren't as good, just simply that. They weren't as good. They weren't as profound because there's something essentially tactical about these stories, and the tactic is directed not at poetry. They have no quarrel with poetry, it seems to me. The tactic is directed towards the story. I've read interviews where she's allowed that maybe these things are poems, and I always recoil a little bit because I hate to say this since I'm a poet and I write a lot about poetry, but people don't associate poetry with extremely rigorous analytic thinking enough. Certainly they should. But when people hear poetry, especially prose poetry, they think of a certain kind of impressionistic word painting, and that is just at the opposite pole from what Lydia Davis does. There's no prettiness for its own sake. There's very little description. There are fewer adjectives than you expect. She's often seems extremely satisfied with a kind of approximate language, which is sort of the kind of opposite of what people mean by poetry, and maybe particularly prose poetry.
You used the word rigorous a lot in describing Davis's virtues. In your review, you take up James Joyce's phrase, scrupulous meanness, which he had used to describe his style in Dubliners,
mm-hmm.
and he places her in a line of scrupulously mean fiction writers, early James Joyce and primarily Beckett before
right.
her.
Right.
She herself has repeatedly spoken of her debt to Beckett specifically. How would you describe this line of the scrupulously mean writers,
mm-hmm.
And how does she fit in with her scrupulously mean predecessors?
Yeah. Well, it's different in every case, but the feeling of a writer bringing slightly less empathy, deliberately slightly less empathy to a character or to a situation than would be the human average or the human minimum. In a way, it creates the opening for the reader's empathy to come and compensate for the lack of authorial empathy. So even in Beckett, who's extremely austere writer, always implies some place for emotionality. It's just not on the page. This style can almost act as a bait or a lure. I think that's at the heart of what she does. What's different about what Davis is up to is the kind of wanting to get daily life, daily emotions, daily annoyances, daily situations, recognizable, quotidian ups and downs into this quite forensic style. And of course, Joyce did that with Dublin daily life, but nobody's done it quite for American daily life in 2010 the way I think Davis has done. But she's never unclenched this extremely analytic, quite, if you didn't like it, you might say kind of parched, abbreviated manner. She's never given that up. She's just found ways of getting a whole range of human situations into it.
How is it that she manages to be one of these difficult, unfriendly writers, and yet she's exactly the kind of thing that you want to share with others? Send in an email to a loved one, or as you bring up in your review, post up outside your office or pass around with friends before dinner.
Yes, I talk in the piece about tacking up to a bulletin board outside of our offices here at Wellesley, the story, and it struck me as in keeping with Davis's method to tack a story up on a bulletin board. Why? Because I think in a way that's what she's always doing to her material. She's saying, here's a specimen of something. Take a look at it and have a response to it. She's not locating herself necessarily within it. She's not saying, here is the final way to regard this subject matter. She's saying, here's a specimen. Have a response to it. And the specimen, it might be a specimen of exceeding coldness. It might be a specimen of only partial understanding. It might be a specimen of misreading. It might be a specimen of misapprehension or of cruelty. Nevertheless, that's what it is. It's a specimen. And the reader's job is to kind of regard it that way so that the relation I put my colleagues into encountering this piece of prose tacked to a bulletin board is, in a way, I think, the relation she has to her material and the relation she puts her readers into towards her material. I mean, the other thing is just not very surprising, but just the brevity and the containedness, self-containedness of the work allows for all kinds of things that you just normally can't do with stories, like memorize them. It's possible, and maybe it's even part of the point, to memorize a poem. And you may memorize paragraphs from a story or from a novel, but you don't usually get the whole thing down and have it in your head. And it is possible to do that, and even inevitable to do that with Davis's stories. And that, to me, feels sort of central to what she's up to. Chewing on them in your head, even after you've put the book down, brings them into daily circulation in a way that longer stories or different kinds of stories aren't in daily circulation. It just puts them into the human world in a way that a longer story or a different kind of story wouldn't be. One other thing about them, and it's a part of their, I suppose, coldness, is she seems to prize kind of ingenuity. And one account of her would say that she is primarily an ingenious, or I guess even a worse word for it would be clever, writer. But the ingenuity has such a deep human emotional root, and I think you get to it. I mean, she is looking and totally capable of finding ways of passing the time. And that passes right on to a reader. You can turn to these things as a kind of improvement upon idle moments. I love the feeling that I can slip one in the 5 minutes before teaching, or even I drove around with this book for quite a while on the passenger seat of my car. And, you know, other people, while they were texting, I was reading stories by Lydia Davis in traffic or at traffic lights. There's something astounding about being able to do that. And it's as though her own self-delighting ingenuity gets passed on to the reader, and here's a little book that we can take along with us to have a Davis-like moment of abated or transformed loneliness or transfigured loneliness.
I think that's probably a good place to end.
Great.
Thank you so much, Dan.